Our last word in business is face-off. Facebook has its lawyers on the offensive. They're chasing down companies with names that end in the word book. The social networking site has forced an upstart called Placebook to change its name. Now it's suing a company called Teachbook, a web community for teachers. And it's not just the word book. Facebook also wants the word face. According to the tech blog TechCrunch, Facebook is trying to trademark the word, but it's facing resistance from a company that owns a mobile phone payment system called FaceCash. And don't forget about FaceTime. That's the video calling service owned by another big company with a lot of lawyers, Apple. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. The pyramids of Egypt, the cherry blossom festival in Japan, the Taj Mahal, all must-visit wonders found in travel guides like 1,000 places to see before you die. Okay, so what about Garbage City outside of Cairo or the annual Poison Oak Show in Columbia, California? These destinations are chronicled in a new guide called 101 Places Not to See Before You Die.
I wanted to create a kind of get-off-the-hook list for people like me who see a list and feel like they have to do everything on it. So this is a book where you don't have to do everything, and some things on it you couldn't do even if you wanted to try.
Catherine Price has written for The New York Times and Salon. Now she's conjured up 101 places that should be scratched off everybody's bucket list. It seems to be these things not to do fall to some degree into categories, and one of those might be odd places to sleep. Tell us about one of the worst places to sleep.
Well, I guess I had a couple on the list, but one that springs to mind is just the general concept of any hotel that used to be a prison. And there's one of those in Latvia, Karostas Sietums is the phonetic pronunciation. And it's basically this former Soviet era prison in Latvia that now has been opened up as a hotel. And it's not like they took the prison and then tried to like spice it up and make it into a luxury resort. They basically market it on the idea that 150 people were shot there and you can sleep on iron beds and you can put your kids in a prison bunk bed for the night. You can actually hire them to do an abduction at your workplace and then have you delivered to the hotel. What appealed to me about that, and this is true for many of the entries in the book, is that they walk the fine line between places you genuinely wouldn't want to see. Like, why would I want to really know what it was like to be a prisoner in this horrible place? But also places that are kind of interesting. You know, it's like part of me kind of wants to check that out just so I'd have the story afterwards.
Well, there's another place that could be similar experience to that is the third infiltration tunnel at the DMZ. That would be the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea. Why don't you tell us about this site?
Sure. That was actually a really interesting experience. I was doing a project in Korea and I had the opportunity to visit the DMZ, and I would have thought this was like a Berlin Wall type thing, but it's actually more of a sidewalk curb dividing North and South Korea. And then there's soldiers on either side just staring at each other. But what happens on the tour is that you put all your stuff into a cubby and they give you this helmet and then they put you on this little train. And if you're like me, you're kind of like lulled into complacency because it kind of seems like a Disneyland ride. And then all of a sudden, with no explanation, they take you down into this narrow, claustrophobic tunnel blasted into solid rock that the North Koreans had blasted, presumably as a potential way to invade.
I like the detail, though, that you mentioned where the North Koreans were trying to pretend that this was a coal mining tunnel.
Yes.
So they'd like painted it, parts of it black.
Yeah, they're like, no, it's not actually to invade. It's a coal mine. And then it's a really bizarre place to be.
One of the destinations that I don't think anyone would have really high expectations for is in Beijing, and it's the Beijing Museum of Tap Water.
Yes, it's a museum dedicated to the history of Beijing's tap water, and you can go in and see artifacts from the early days of Beijing's tap water system, which started in 1908. You can see coupons people used to have to bring to the water stations in order to get the water. You can see stethoscopes that were used to listen for leaks in the pipes. But what I find the funniest thing about this is that Beijing's water is actually not safe to drink from the tap.
another something that begins with the mundane. There's also the Seattle Gum Wall, which is apparently visited by quite a few people on a regular basis. But in fact, it's a place you would say don't go.
I think I would genuinely say don't bother with the Seattle Gum Wall before you die. I think that I don't even need to give any qualifications there. I mean, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a wall where people have put gum. I don't know, if I'm sitting in the movie and I feel under the seat and I touch a piece of chewed gum, my response is not, wow, I really wish I could see a whole wall of more of that. Yeah, I don't think it's really necessary to visit.
We're talking to Catherine Price about her book, 101 Places Not to See Before You Die. Now, I gather you got in trouble at least about one of these destinations, and that's the Blarney Stone in Ireland.
Oh, yeah. Got in big trouble for that. I'm also in trouble with Nevada because I included the entire state. But for the Blarney Stone, when I hear about a destination whose main attraction is giving you the chance to kiss a piece of stone that's been kissed by hundreds of thousands of people, that is not something that I personally need to do. But as you can imagine, the tourist board, and in particular the marketing department of the Blarney Stone, was not really excited to hear that that was on the list. I actually had a very sweet exchange with the woman in charge, and she would like me and therefore all of our listeners to know that you can actually request a special cleaning of the stone before you kiss it if you would like.
So you're actually traveling right now in Europe. Tell us if you found some new places to add to your list.
Yes, so I'm actually on a really exciting trip with my husband right now. And one place I wouldn't recommend is I just went to the Turin Museum of Anatomy. I don't know if you've heard of this.
No, but anatomy's giving me a funny feeling already for some reason.
Right, so this is basically like a big room with all these glass cases with dried out body parts in them. There are like fingers preserved in formaldehyde. There are desiccated lungs, intestines. And most bizarrely, there's this skeleton sitting there of the guy who founded the museum, because he left him a note in his will saying, I don't want to be buried. I don't want to be cremated. I want to be preserved using the techniques that I myself developed and be put on display in the museum. So there's this skeleton with his brain preserved by his own methods sitting at his feet. very weird. I enjoy talking about it, but I don't think on a hot Turin afternoon it was really something I needed to do.
Catherine Price, whose new book offers a guide to 101 places not to see before you die. And at NPR.org, we've posted photos of some of those very destinations, so you can take a look at the Seattle Gum Wall.
From NPR News, this is Morning Edition. Our supervisory editor is Kevin Langley. Our technical director, Brian Jarbo. Audio engineers include Arthur Halliday-Laurent, Greg Gabin, Vince Muse, Ted Mebane, Kurt Stallnaker, Gary Henderson, Stacey Abbott, Renee Pringle.
With Theo Mondel here at NPR West. Our executive producer is Madalika Sicka. The executive director of news programming is Ellen McDonald. Morning Edition's theme music was written by BJ Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. Steve Inskeep will be back with us on Monday. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
Any day now, 6,000 elementary teachers here in Los Angeles will see their names published online, along with data showing how much their students improved on standardized tests. The Los Angeles Times has promised to release the information to help parents measure how effective the teachers are. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, the database has sparked a debate on how to evaluate teachers.
The Times stories use some fancy number crunching to compare the effectiveness of teachers in the nation's second largest school system. It has led to an explosive controversy in the city. Some argue it's about time parents had an objective measure to compare their kids' teachers. Others say this is just a way to humiliate educators.
We are outraged that the Times would put this out and put people in harm's way.
A.J. Duffy is president of the United Teachers of Los Angeles. So far, the newspaper has only published analyses of individual teachers and schools. The union has tried to get out in front of the story by publishing critiques of the method used to compare the scores. It's known as the value-added method because it compares test score gains or declines.
At this point, value-added is so flawed that I could not agree that it would be a useful tool.
A.J. Duffy has received some support from researchers who agree the value-added approach is open to error and that those mistakes could lead parents and administrators to the wrong conclusions. A number of papers over the past year have cautioned that there are just too many variables in student performance to rely heavily on student test scores. Tim Sass of Florida State University says there are dozens of factors outside a teacher's control that can limit improvement in test scores. For example,
the principal always gives the weaker students to the new teachers, let's say, and tends to favor their more senior teachers at their school.
The LA Times analysis carefully tries to correct for that and for many other variables. And in fact, value-added analysis is a well-accepted approach that has been used for decades in education research, though not for the purpose of publicly comparing individual teachers. William Sanders, one of the fathers of value-added, now works for a research company called SAS. Sanders says value-added analysis can accurately single out star performers or ineffective teachers, but as to those in between,
can you distinguish within the middle? No, you can't. Even with the most rigorous, robust, value-added process that you can bring to the problem.
And Sanders worries that parents may come to the wrong conclusions about those middle performers. The Los Angeles Unified School District admits it has been sitting on this data and hasn't used it to help teachers improve. Now, Deputy Superintendent John Dacey says the real tragedy would be if all this information were simply ignored.
So you would never evaluate a teacher on only using this metric. On the other hand, you wouldn't, in my opinion, evaluate a teacher completely not considering how students are doing over time in achievement.
Dacey says the controversy is now spurring the district to develop a new teacher evaluation system that uses value-added data. Union President A.J. Duffy says, slow down.
They can't. It has to be negotiated.
The two sides have agreed to sit down and talk. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
When school starts next month in Los Angeles, the doors will open at what's been dubbed the Taj Mahal of public schools. The Robert F. Kennedy Community Schools in downtown L.A. cost close to $600 million. That makes it the most expensive in the country. Supporters say the money was approved in 2006 when Taj Mahal might have felt a little bit more like a compliment.
Ever since the ancient Greeks told stories about their gods behaving badly, people have been entranced by scandal. Why do we love reading about it so much? A new book by Laura Kipnis tries to answer that question, and Susan Jane Gilman has this review.
If scandals teach us anything, it's that we shouldn't judge a book by its cover. A priest can be a pedophile. An all-American golf pro can cheat on his wife. A sanctimonious politician? Well, how much time do you have? Yet Laura Kipnis's new book is like its cover. The provocative title, How to Become a Scandal, Adventures and Bad Behavior, leads you to expect a lurid, splashy package with bold lettering. Instead, with its neat white jacket, the book looks almost prim. And this isn't off base. Kipnis has taken on a big, titillating, inflammatory subject rather timidly. To be fair, How to Become a Scandal is spirited and smart. Kipnis is a professor attempting to break new ground in scholarship. We lack any real theory of scandal, she writes. There's no scandal philosophy or psychology. Intellectually speaking, it's pretty much virgin terrain. Given how much bad behavior is making the headlines these days, her call is spot on. Why not try to understand what compels so many smart people to do stupid, immoral, and degrading things? And what does compel us, the public, to salivate over their downfall? Because scandals remind us of our most carnal selves, Kipnis explains, they trigger conflicting impulses, both to indulge and to punish. When a few hapless figures are caught with their pants down, we get to live out our own taboo desires through them vicariously. At the same time, we get to experience a rush of indignation and righteousness. Her book profiles four tabloid stars in depth. The lovelorn astronaut caught stalking her romantic rival in diapers. A New York judge jailed after bizarrely trying to extort money from his mistress. Linda Tripp, reviled wire-wearing whistleblower in the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal. And James Fry, a fake memoir infamy. Yet, like our subjects, Kittness doesn't always fulfill her best intentions. Although How to Become a Scandal takes an intelligent look at the psychology behind bad behavior, the second part gives way to deconstructions of Linda Tripp and James Fry, at which point the book's thesis blurs. And Kittness also leaves many American scandals unmentioned. I've avoided the glitziest cases, which tend to become too encrusted with opinion to yield surprises, she writes. Fine, but this feels like a cop-out. Why not take on the most infamous scandals and recast them with fresh insight? Isn't this precisely what new scholarship should do? Besides, you're discussing scandal. Don't pussyfoot around. Furthermore, some scandals are not delicious. They expose true hypocrisy, rottenness, and crime. Again, think Catholic Church. These scandals have not been greeted with secret, nasty glee by the public, only horror and a call for justice. They're a different breed, to be sure, and they serve a loftier purpose, but Kittness never addresses them. In How to Become a Scandal, she's launched a promising new field of inquiry, but she needs to expand upon it and, like her subjects, grow bolder and more brazen.
Susan Jane Gilman is the author of Undress Me in the Temple of Heaven. You can read an excerpt of the book, How to Become a Scandal, Adventures in Bad Behavior. That's at our website, npr.org.
This is NPR.
In the field of astronomy these days, it is raining planets. Two leading teams of planet hunters announced this week they'd found entire solar systems, one with two or three planets, the other with as many as seven. These are not planets that could sustain life, but many scientists say detecting such planets is looking more likely. NPR's Dan Charles has more.
Many of the world's experts on planets in outer space are playing top this at a scientific conference in southeastern France this week. Among them is Matthew Holman from the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics.
There's always an element of competition. You know, people come and want to show their best work and they want to surprise their colleagues.
Holman had to keep his own surprise under wraps for a few days because it hadn't yet been published. So he just listened as his European competitors claimed the spotlight. Christoph Lovis from the University of Geneva in Switzerland announced on Tuesday his group had discovered a whole collection of planets orbiting a star 127 light years away.
At least five planets and probably seven. Two of them are still a little bit uncertain.
It's the largest solar system ever seen outside our own. Now, Lovis didn't really see any of those planets. So far, that's impossible. He watched stars very carefully as they move through space. If they speed up or slow down a little in a regular pattern, it shows there's something tugging on them, the gravitational pull of an orbiting planet. This has been the most successful planet hunting technique, but it works best for giant planets close to small stars. Of the 500 planets discovered so far, most have been like this. One of the new planets that Lovis announced, however, appears to be much smaller. Its mass is just 40% greater than Earth.
We've really moved from giant planets only to any kind of planetary system with more and more planets, small mass planets, and so on. It's really exciting.
And yesterday, Matthew Holman finally got to add his bit of excitement when his discovery was published by the journal Science.
We're announcing the discovery of two Saturn-sized planets, which we call Kepler-9b and Kepler-9c.
And there's evidence of a third planet, he said, a much smaller one. Its diameter appears to be just 50% larger than Earth's.
If it is confirmed, it would have a radius of about 1.5 times the radius of the Earth.
Holman's discovery, in fact, is an early scientific harvest from NASA's new planet-finding machine, a telescope called Kepler. This instrument is following Earth in its orbit around the Sun, staring constantly at a group of 100,000 stars in another corner of our galaxy. When the light from any of those stars dims slightly, it's evidence that a planet just crossed in front of it. Now, the planets that scientists have found so far are not what you'd call habitable. The small ones are way too close to their stars. But Kepler was designed specifically to detect planets just like Earth. And Alan Boss, an astrophysicist at the Carnegie Institution of Washington, is increasingly confident those planets are out there.
We're finding more and more evidence that Earth-like planets are going to be quite common. We don't have them yet, but we're well along the way towards discovering them.
We'll all have to be patient, though. A planet just like Earth crosses in front of its star once a year, and scientists won't declare it a planet until they see the star's light dim at least three times. Dan Charles, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This week we're hearing about primary care under pressure. Primary care is the basic medical care people need. Today, NPR's Julie Robner visits a nonprofit medical clinic in Maine. It's among those around the country pioneering a concept called a medical home. The idea is to make health care more effective and more efficient for both doctors and patients. And it may help attract more doctors to primary care practice.
As recently as a couple of years ago, Doug Cooper was like a lot of primary care doctors, overworked and unhappy.
I was here for 12-hour days and felt like times like I had no personal life and no flexibility. And I was in this office or in the two exam rooms and just spent the time ping-ponging back and forth.
It got so bad at one point, he even considered leaving medicine. But he realized he couldn't.
That's not where I want to go. I really like taking care of patients. I like the interaction, that personal one-on-one encounter.
Things are different now. His work life is much more sane. There's even a bicycle wedged up between the desk and the wall in his tiny cubicle of an office.
That's one big thing, is that I can get here and back home during daylight hours on a bicycle.
Doug Cooper was one of several people who developed a whole new way of practicing primary care medicine at Martin's Point. He now works more as part of a team he leads. It helps doctors offload some of their daily work to nurses and other practitioners, but also helps improve the quality of care patients get. In a lot of ways, it's sort of a recreation of the old-time general practitioner's office, where every person in the office knew every patient.
Hi, Mark. It's Patty with Dr. Cooper's office. How can I help you?
Patty O'Regan is a registered nurse and a key member of the team.
Oh, okay.
She used to sit down the hall and around the corner.
Right.
Now she sits at a desk right outside Cooper's office so they can ask and answer each other's questions more easily. O'Regan actually quit Martin's Point a couple of years ago. She says she couldn't handle the pace and the lack of organization.
There was no question it had to change. You couldn't keep doing it the way we were doing it.
One way the new approach, this medical home, helps streamline things is by letting each member of the team do what they're most qualified to under law. It's called practicing to the top of their license. What it really means is having doctors like Doug Cooper give up some control.
You know, some of this is really learning to work together and trust your team.
For example, Cooper now has Nurse O'Regan do most prescription refills. He says it's been a major time saver.
I would get 20, 30, I'm not sure I could count how many refill requests in a given day.
The team has also worked on saving time for patients, literally. Cooper wanted to know how long it took from the time they walked in the door until the time they were ready to walk out.
The patient is given a clipboard with a stopwatch and a pen, and they're told, keep track. And they're all over it. They love it. They're like, okay.
But working as a team is about a lot more than efficiency. A medical home is also supposed to be about improving the quality of health care. That brings Cooper to the non-human member of his team, Martin's Point's electronic medical record. It's there in the exam room when he's seeing a patient.
And so how's the heart been doing?
Well.
No chest pains?
No chest pains.
And back in his office, Cooper can really demonstrate what he can do with all that data he and others have just typed in.
Patient names. I can put a filter on here and select only Dr. Cooper patients, so I can
with a couple of clicks, he calls up a database of all his patients with high blood pressure.
And then I can start manipulating this data. I can get in and I can say, okay, everybody here has an elevated blood pressure. Let's go look at their previous blood pressure.
Now he's looking at how long it's been since they've last been in the office.
I can say, okay, here's a couple patients who haven't been in a couple of years.
And he'll have Patty or his medical assistant, Tricia, call to schedule an appointment. But even that's not what gives the number 11 Cooper his biggest thrill. What he really wants to show off is what's just outside his office.
The wall of knowledge.
The wall of knowledge. It's where Cooper really geeks out. tracking the health of his entire patient population on a pair of bulletin boards. There's a mind-boggling series of charts and graphs. He can tell you, for example, that 98% of his hypertension patients now have their blood pressure under control. But unless Cooper's patients happen to stop and look, all this is basically invisible. Which explains why, if you ask long-time patients, like Goldie McKenney, if they perceive any change, they say no.
It's just very efficient. Everything is goes like clockwork for us. Yeah, we're just content with all the care we get.
And Cooper says that's just as it should be. For most patients, nothing appears to have changed. But for some patients, the medical home has meant access to services they didn't have before. For example, Martin's Point also has health educators, people like nurse practitioner Alicia Greenwald. She specializes in diabetes education.
My nickname is the Diabetes Queen. I have a crown to prove it.
Greenwald's job is to see patients who need more time to work through medication or even social issues connected with their disease.
I didn't tell anybody, but I was getting...
Today she's seeing a sprightly 88-year-old named Mary Coyne, who's suffering from a common diabetic complication called neuropathy.
Not bed bugs, but something.
And that's exactly what a lot of people describe neuropathy to feel like to them.
Afterwards, Greenwald says many patients just need someone to explain what's going on.
She didn't really know what the word was. She didn't really understand that feeling like bugs were biting her was a symptom of neuropathy, and she needed clarification on that so that she knew that she didn't have bed bugs, which is what she was worried about.
But while doctors and patients may be happier and healthier in Martin's Point's medical home, what will really determine the success or failure of the medical home is whether or not it actually saves money. That's a big concern for Lisa Letourneau. She's heading up a separate program to build more medical homes in Maine. She says many of the ongoing experiments aren't focused enough on costs.
And I'm afraid that's going to bite us in the end. You know, unless we can demonstrate this not only improves quality and patient experience and controls costs, we're going to be stuck.
But in order to really make that all happen, quality, efficiency, and cost, there's going to have to be serious attitude adjustments on the part of both doctors and their patients. Martin's Point CEO David Howes says more doctors will have to get over the idea that they're the only ones qualified to deliver medical care.
And if we can't help physicians to move from a place where they are the center of every decision that is made to a place where they can delegate and share decisions with trusted teammates, then this won't work.
Meanwhile, says Letourneau, patients will have to do some compromising, too.
We are used to, in America, more is better. We apply that to healthcare. We assume that more healthcare is better, and it is not. And in fact, it is often dangerous to us.
Expect to see more medical homes popping up around the country. The new health law includes funding to help more primary care providers transform their practices into care teams like those at Martin's Point. Julie Rovner, NPR News.
And tomorrow, Julie wraps up her series with a visit to a physician assistant. Along with nurse practitioners, physician assistants are helping to alleviate the shortage of primary care doctors in the country.